electric button.
The third electric button.
Okay, very good. So, Somani's made the case that the public isn't getting the fact that climate change is a threat to our health. And I want us to consider whether or not maybe we're partially complicit in that. Maybe we haven't actually been making the case to the public that climate change is a threat to our health. And so my presentation is all about engaging the public in climate change, how public health professionals can make the case. And I'm actually going to conclude with an ask of you. I want you to think, in my presentation, I want you to reflect on whether or not you would feel comfortable making the case, going out and in a variety of ways, engaging members of your community in the issue of climate change, helping them to make that connection between something which they clearly have cognitive connections to currently, but those cognitive connections do not include a threat to the health of themselves, their family, members of their community. We're going to do a very brief who, what, where, why, and how. So the question is who should we be engaging? The question is what should we do to actually engage different segments of the audience? Why us? Why us public health professionals? Why should we be doing the engaging? And how? How can we engage the public in this issue? So let's begin with the who. Who should be doing the engaging? Well, I've put my own photo on this slide, so I clearly include myself in this group. I feel that it's well worth my time as part of my day job as well as part of my private time to go out and engage members of my community in this issue. Spend a lot of time doing it. I most enjoy going to schools, middle schools and high schools, largely because I spend so much time with middle schoolers and high schoolers, which is my children's age, and I've learned how to make this issue relevant to them, and it's just incredibly gratifying to lay the issues out for them. But I also want you to insert your photo on this slide. I didn't know who would be here, so I didn't insert your photos, but you go right there in the middle, and these lovely students from University of Nevada, Las Vegas, I just love them. I found their photo on the web, and to me, they are archetypal of public health professionals. They are so they're serious, and they're earnest, and they're sincere, and they are exactly the kind of people who I believe need to be going out and making the case that climate change is a threat to people. So the next question, who is it that we should be engaging? This is a topic that we could spend a lot of time talking about. I'm going to do a very rapid fly through and just try to create a couple of simple answers to this question. And actually, some of it is coming from research that Matt Nesbitt and I and some other colleagues are currently doing. As a matter of fact, this research is so in the mix right now that I've even changed the names of these audience segments. What we've done is we've taken a survey that Tony Lazarowitz did in the summer of 2007. He asked three buckets of questions. He asked people about their climate change beliefs, their global warming beliefs. He asked them about the behaviors that they're engaged in or not engaged in, and he asked them about their policy preferences. How is it you would like to deal with the issue of climate change from a policy perspective. We did an audience segmentation analysis. We identified six segments of the general adult population. The names on these slots that I've labeled them here, they're not. I've ditched those. These were the names that were current as of last Monday when I had to upload this presentation. I'm going to give you new names. But the way you read this slide is it's actually like a book. You read from left to right, top to bottom. So the first, they are arrayed in a continuum from the segment that cares most to the segment that cares least. I'm currently calling the segment that cares most the anxiously alarmed. They're about one out of five adults, 19% of the population. I've only given you a little bit of information about them, but I think in many ways it's the most interesting information. They believe that climate change is hurting people now. People are already being harmed by climate change. And they also believe that climate change is a very serious threat to people in their community. This is a group of Americans who have clearly personalized the threat. The next group over, which I'm calling the convinced and concerned, 22% of the public, they believe that the people will be hurt as a result of climate change within 10 years. not now, but within 10 years. And they actually see it as the threat to climate change, the threat to people in their community associated with climate change is something less than somewhat serious. In other words, I'm trying to translate numbers into words for you, but they gave a number that indicated on average they thought it was something less than somewhat serious on a Likert scale. The next group over, which I'm now calling the cautiously concerned, 20% of the public, they believe that people will be harmed within 20 years. Pretty remarkable that we're seeing immediate, people are already being harmed, 10 years, 20 years. They actually, however, unlike the convinced and concerned, they see the threat to people in their community as somewhat greater. They see it as a somewhat serious threat. Down here, the fourth segment, which I'm now calling the prudent protectors, 12% of the public, a smaller group, they believe that people will be hurt within 40 years. So as we go across the continuum of segments, they're seeing this as a problem that will accrue further and further out, temporally more distant in our lives. And with regard to the people in their own community, they see it as not a very serious threat. The fifth group, I'm now calling them the distant doubters, 16% of the public, they believe people won't be harmed for 75 years. And also, like the prudent protectors, they don't see it as a very serious threat to people in their community. And finally, the group that I'm calling the dismissive doubters, 11% of the public, and I hope all of you are as gratified as I am that it's only 11% of the public who fall in this most, you know, who fall in the group that some people call denialist or skeptics. They believe that people will never be hurt because they believe climate change isn't real. It's not a serious threat to members of their community or any community. So I didn't really want to dwell on that, but because this is my current research, I'm quite excited by it. A second segment of the public, if you will, that we've got to engage, not just the general public and segments of them, but the business community. And the business community, like the general public, they're not a unitary whole. There are different industries. Different industries are already thinking about climate change differently, and we've got to find a way to make the case more effectively, to engage members of those different industries in the issue. Won't go into that anymore. Perhaps less important in terms of actual complicity in creating the problem, but very important in terms of engagement in our lives, are the non-governmental organizations in our communities. They aren't large contributors of greenhouse gas pollution, but they do touch our lives in a variety of ways. And until the NGOs in our communities, and in that I include schools, professional associations, volunteer agencies, community organizations, and other types of NGOs, until they are engaged, acknowledging climate change as one of the major issues of our time, it's a very important lost opportunity to instate a social norm that this is a problem that we must engage in, rally to, and ultimately find ways to solve. And then finally, a segment of our community that we need to engage are the very people that we essentially elect and appoint to run our community, namely our governments. Climate change will never be a problem that is solvable without significant policy change. And those policies accrue at the local level, the state level, the federal level, as well as the international level. And until we do a much better job than we've done of engaging the people who run our governments and the people who want to run our governments in this issue, we will not be developing the solutions that we so desperately need. So what, now we're to the what portion of this presentation, what exactly is it that we want to accomplish through engagement? And what I'm about to egregiously oversimplify, but bear with me. Sometimes it's helpful to have an oversimplification, simply to have something clear in our minds. I think we need the engagement to accomplish three things. Firstly, we need to change people's and organizations' consumption behaviors. There are certain behaviors we would like to see decreased. There are other behaviors we would like to see increased. Secondly, we would like to see not people, but organizations, businesses, NGOs, and particularly governments adopt policies that will ultimately help to mitigate and help us adapt to the threat of climate change. And then finally, I suggest that the thing that we most need to engage. The most compelling reason to engage the public is because the public has a unique ability to advocate for change, to use their our collective voice, our collective voice with retailers, the businesses that we patronize, our collective voice as citizens to shape government policies, and those are really the three things that we need to accomplish through public engagement. You don't need to worry so much about the details on this slide. I'm only trying to make the point that I think I ripped this off from my good friend Howard Frumkin, who's in the room. He makes the point that there are sort of five buckets of consumer behavior that we need to influence. The way people eat, the way people travel, the way people buy, the way people work. And I had to get an ing since I had ing's verbs. I turned all the others into verbs. I had to create the way we run our homes into domiciling. I hope you appreciate just how clever that really was. And some of those behaviors, we're looking to decrease certain behaviors in each of those five buckets of each of those five domains of life, and we're looking to increase other behaviors. Again, I don't want to get caught up into the details. The second thing that we're trying to do, as I've already said, in terms of the public, is we want to engage the public to use their collective voice, our collective voice, in putting positive pressure on business, on NGOs, and on government to adopt, to reduce their own CO2 emissions directly through their operations and their policy, and then to actually, in the case of businesses and NGOs, to advocate for appropriate public policy to stop being part of the problem, part of the opposition, and start being part of the solution. And then finally, to actually, with regard to governments particularly, to enact appropriate public policies. It's an incredibly powerful use of public engagement to get us to use our collective influence in this fashion. With regard to what we want from businesses, from NGOs, and from our governments, it's really, I think, fairly simplified into a three-step process with a little kicker at the end. The three steps are: we want those organizations to inventory their own greenhouse gas emissions. We want them, secondly, we want them to set greenhouse gas reduction goals and aggressively pursue them. And then thirdly, we're asking them to report back to us how well are you doing. We need transparency in this effort. We can't just trust you. You need to show us. And it's that simple three-step model, which is absolutely iterative. But then the kicker, the fourth step, is we want you, businesses and NGOs, we want you to advocate for appropriate public policies as well. Because as I've said three times now, this isn't a problem we're going to solve without appropriate public policies. Oops, excuse me. And then finally, there's a unique role for government agencies in this, in engaging the public and in developing solutions. I believe this is, I'm blanking his name, I've been citing him lately, a fabulous law professor from Vanderbilt, who says that we have essentially, our governments have three fundamental options for influencing the behavior of the public. One is carrots. We can offer incentives. We can help various segments of the public pursue the goals that they've laid out for themselves. Secondly is sticks or regulation. We can force them to do so. That's not an option that we as Americans are so ready to embrace. We tend not to like that option, but in certain instances we use it. When we do use it in public health, we tend to achieve the objectives that we've laid out for ourselves. And then finally, sermons. This is my business. I'm a public health communicator, and sermonizing is sometimes very out of vogue. We don't necessarily believe that it's the government's business to tell the people what to do. But one thing I can tell you, because I've just done a review of climate change, national climate change communication campaigns around the world, as it turns out, there's only three national campaigns that have been implemented and adequately evaluated that we would know whether or not they worked: Canada, UK, and Sweden. All three worked. All three worked remarkably well. All three were incredibly inexpensive on a per capita basis, and all three were terminated prematurely for either as a result of a change in government or a a budgetary constraint, budgetary shortfalls leading to early termination of the program. So it's interesting that this tool, this policy tool that our governments have, sermonizing to change, to encourage people to change their behavior, it works, but we've yet to see a single sustained national effort anywhere in the world. So why us? Coming back to this slide again. Well, why us? Because of the following. Samani mentioned the fact that when you ask Americans to tell you what they associate with climate change, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think about global warming? What they will essentially tell you is, I think about plants, penguins, or polar bears. They think about features of the natural environment. They do not think about human beings. When they do think about human beings, they think about one of two specific groups of human beings, either the alarmists that Simani talked about, people who seem overly concerned about climate change, and that's not necessarily a very attractive quality, or they think about the naysayers, the people who are poo-pooing the whole thing, and that's not very attractive either. So for the vast majority of Americans, they make no connection between climate change and our health. Whoops. John Krosnick at Stanford has done some research, really some uniquely insightful research, which shows that people who understand the issue and who are ready to see serious policy change, policy formulated in response, but have four key beliefs. They believe that climate change is real and they're certain of it. They believe that it's human caused. They believe that it's harmful to people. Read that as public health, and they believe that the problem can be solved. I now have only 30 seconds left, so I'm going to have to skip through this. This is my most important slide, but let me simply draw your attention to the fact that the majority of the public already believes that climate change is real. The majority already believes that it's human-caused, but when you look on the third line down, the proportion of the public who believe that it's harmful to people, 40% in 2007, 40% of American adults believed it was harmful to people somewhere. 30% believed it would be harmful to people in the U.S., and 18% believed it would be harmful to people in my community. A fairly profound disconnect that I believe that we, as public health professionals, can help correct. Don't have time for that. But we do have time for my ask. I told you I was going to make an ask. I have made it my business to create a Lunch and Learn PowerPoint presentation. It's a PowerPoint presentation uniquely crafted to be given by public health professionals in their community. And this particular one, I've put my own name on it because I've been out testing this thing. I've been trying it out myself. Sometimes I get good response. Sometimes I get some really tough questions. APHA plans to co-sponsor this with me. They have not yet blessed it, so I've sort of done an end run and ripped off their logo and put it on my presentation. The same is true for CDC. We are going to try to run this through CDC clearance so that CDC can co-sponsor this presentation. We don't have that clearance yet, so that use of the CDC logo is completely unauthorized. And for those of you who agree to work on this with me, you can put your institution's logo there as well. The presentation, as I've said, it's a 30-minute lunch and learn. It's completely appropriate for any kind of community-based presentation. Its highest and best use, however, would be for use with your own town council, your county council, your city council, for use in convincing the people who hold the local public health budget in your community that this is an issue worth investing in. It will not surprise you that the entire agenda for the Lunch and Learn is structured around those four key beliefs that I introduced you to a moment ago. The presentation is structured so that you can make the point that global warming is real, it's human caused, it is very bad for people, and it is a solvable problem. That format is working really well. We go a little bit light on it's real and it's human caused because none of you are climate scientists. I am not a climate scientist. I don't want to represent that science in my community other than the fact that it's settled. The issue is settled. So I focus the presentation on it's bad for people, and as a public health professional, let me tell you how. So let us close here with this lovely slide. Again, it's an idea that I ripped off from my dear friend Howard Frumkin. We see that the simple, loving act of walking your children to school rather than driving them to school or putting them on the school bus It has so many benefits. That simple loving act reduces CO2 emissions, increases physical activity, for mother and two children, reduces all of their risk of osteoporosis, reducing likelihood of injury, reducing air pollution in their community, lowering infrastructure costs in their community, increasing social capital by connecting people in the community to one another again, thereby decreasing rates of depression, increasing happiness. And for all of you who are willing to accept my challenge, my request to go out and try this presentation, which will be finalized without CDC and APHA, well, certainly without CDC's logo by next week, but it might have APHA's logo by next week. If you're willing to take me up on this ask, send me an email here at climate@gmu.edu, and I will make sure you get a copy of this presentation by next week at the latest. So thank you for your time. Please work with me on this project. I think we as public health professionals have a really unique and important role to exploit here.